From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Well, the sun don't sink, it don't swim, it don't sit. Is it androids or elephants?
The long and winding history of the Flatlanders begins in the honky-tonks of West Texas. It was on those gritty stages that Joe Ely, Butch Hancock, and Jimmie Dale Gilmore watched guitarists like Buddy Holly and Roy Orbison create a sound that would bring country blues to rock and roll. These three long-haired high school buddies came together as the Flatlanders and tripped the clock by playing rootsy rock and country tunes long before the genre had a name. Their first album, recorded in Nashville in 1972, didn't go very far. The band broke up, but the three stayed tight throughout their soaring solo careers. The tapes of that 72 session got around, finally making it onto a CD as More Legend Than a Band in 1990. Well, 30 years and another release later, the Flatlanders are together again. Now they're out with Wheels of Fortune, forging together blues, folk, and western swing that carry on the legacy of the lonely troubadours of the past. From the sound of it, they're enjoying each other's company again, and we can certainly enjoy them. Tonight on Point, coming home with the Flatlanders.
Up the high road to heaven, down the slow road to sleep. You just keep making promises you can't seem to keep. I woke up on the airplane with tears on my cheek. Baby, do you love me still?
And joining me now from Austin, Texas, are Flatlanders Joe Ely, Butch Hancock, and Jimmie Dale Gilmore. They're touring together in support of that new CD, Wheels of Fortune. And gentlemen, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Hello.
Thank you.
Yeah. Good to be here.
Joe, let me start with you. I want to ask about that first record that, as we just said, didn't go very far, and yet all three of you went on to very successful solo careers. Was there something missing in that early collaboration, or was the world just not quite ready yet for the Flatlanders?
A little bit of each. I think that, you know, we did it in Nashville, and they tried to turn it into like a country recording, and I just don't think that it was exactly what was playing in 1972. I think if they'd have released it in San Francisco, it'd have been a whole different thing.
Really? How so?
Well, because it was kind of a, you know, at that time there was a lot of people experimenting with just all different kinds of things, new ways of writing lyrics and putting music together with things. And that recording didn't really have, there was no drums on it. It was a all acoustic thing. It had a saw player, which was not really the instrument of choice in
didn't hear a lot of
country
that
radio. And so it was a little bit 90 degrees from whatever thing else was doing. But I think if it had found a different audience, it would have people would have loved it, mm-hmm. which they did later, 20 years later. So.
Exactly. You just had to wait a little bit to become that overnight success, at least as a group. Well, so what happened then? Did the three of you look at each other and say, well, all right, that's that, I'm done, or fine, I'm going to find my own voice as a solo and go off and do my own thing?
The thing that happened was just the thing that happened with us all the time. We were always just, you know, heading out in different directions. And so there really nothing really happened. It was just that we just went off in different directions, and the record just wasn't there, you know, not until years later. So.
And Butch, what was the direction you went in?
Oh, man, straight up, I think. It was like up to upstairs Texas. I headed up the panhandle about 100 miles for a while and then down to Austin and started playing in all the little joints. Jimmy and Joe had been down there in Austin a few years back, and right before the Flatlanders got together. So I wound up in Austin just kind of starting my solo career down there. And we kept crossing paths in odd places from Colorado to Joe was out on the circus circuit for a little while with the world's tiniest llama or horse. Which one was it?
It was the world's smallest horse.
Yeah. And, so.
I'm tempted to say how small was it, but I'm not sure if I should.
Well, here, I'll show you. It was about this big.
Got it.
Okay.
And Jimmie Dale, how about you? I understand you spent much of the 70s in an ashram in Denver.
Well, no, I stayed in an ashram for a very short period, actually in New Orleans. But when I was in Denver, I lived amongst a community of people that were all studying meditation and philosophy, I guess. And we had a guru. And in a sense, it was more like a bunch, like church people that go to services every single night. We were fanatics. But I couldn't flatter myself by saying that I lived in an ashram, because I never did have the discipline for that.
But you're described as the sort of Zen country poetic voice of the group.
I don't know. Maybe I've just talked about that stuff more than we all always had a lot of common interest in a whole lot of different directions, you know. And Butch and Joe and I and all of our circle of friends, we shared an interest in, besides the music, there, you know, was art and literature, and one of the phases of it was philosophy and I guess spirituality, for want of a better word. It wasn't something that was really alien to our whole circle of friends, even back then.
But in much of your music, certainly from what I heard on Wheel of Fortune, you want to listen to the words. You know, it's not just kind of background. You really want to pay attention to what you're saying in those lyrics.
We like words.
Yeah, we hope so. That's the music we loved the most was always, we all were blues fans, and each of the three of us had a lot of different background when we first met each other, you know, and we turned each other on to a whole lot of different music. So we had kind of three libraries and directions we were coming from that kind of osmosed into all of us, I think. I think that one of the factors was that all of us always liked driving music. We liked really rhythmic stuff, you know, but we also liked good words, good lyrics.
All right, well, let's hear some of those good lyrics and good music. What are you going to play for us now?
This song called Wheels of Fortune.
Well, I made a few mistakes by pitching pennies, and I've struck some matches down some dirty streets. And the fires of love I've lit have burned to ashes, and now they're only smoldering at my feet. And I made a few mistakes by tossing coins. Yeah, I got the longest living losing streak. But if you will be a gal of mine, you can make my money shine. Come on, baby, make that Lincoln penny speed. Oh, babe, you can turn my wheels of fortune till you find some wheel of fortune all your own. But don't you turn the wheels of love unless you're watching, 'cause a blind love can turn your heart. I used to wish on magic. I used to wish on a wishing well. But now I'm only wishing on a star. Oh, babe, you can turn my wheels of fortune till you find some wheel of wheels of love unless you're watching.
And that was Wheels of Fortune, the title track from the new CD. And Butch Hancock, that's one you wrote.
I did write it, yeah. I got in a habit of writing lots of songs back in my tractor-driving days in Lubbock, and I hadn't really stopped since.
And I want to ask, as you were touring as a band, you did tour for last year before you laid down the tracks for Wheels of Fortune, and I'm wondering how life on the road perhaps shaped that sound even more, or was that something that was just almost instinctive when you first came together?
No, I think just kind of re-coming together, we actually found a new sound, and being on the road together last year, at the end of the tour, we just kind of took it all back into the studio and kept that rolling energy up and put down the tracks for this record just to keep that kind of sound going and keep everybody fresh.
And when you got back together, when you began performing together again, was it something of a surprise when this sound emerged? I mean, did you look at each other and kind of go, whoa, that's nice? Or was it something that you just kind of assumed would be there?
Well, I think by our nature, everything has always been a surprise. And, you know, any time we've ever gone on a stage together from all the way back, we never knew what was going to happen next. And we do write set lists now and sometimes stick to them. I think the way our approach to all of it is get real good songs and get really good musicians to play with you and then see what happens. We were that way to begin with.
Is there ever any arm wrestling over, let's do this one, no, let's do this one?
Mm. No, we have a pretty much a way of, we tend to manage to get a consensus without much effort. We don't even know how it works. It's a very mysterious process.
Well, I'll certainly agree with you about that, Jimmy.
Mysterious is the word here.
Yeah.
Now, what about when you're out performing live? As you know, this first recording that you all did back in 1972 developed something of a cult following. Do you have people asking for those songs, or are they also willing to hear what you're doing together that may be new to them?
Usually we play the new stuff, but every once in a while we'll throw in some of the old songs. But, you know, that almost seems like another lifetime ago. So we carry a little bit of that and a little bit of what we're doing at the present.
But it must feel good that people do remember it and kind of hold that first effort of yours in their hearts.
Yeah, it's downright amazing.
All right, well, we're going to take a break, and we want to hear a little more music as we do that. We're talking this hour with the Flatlanders, Joe Ely, Butch Hancock, and Jimmy Dale Gilmore. Their new CD, Wheels of Fortune, is in stores now. We're going to go into the break listening to Indian Cowboy. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
If you ever go out to the circus where the wallenders walk on the wire, I'll tell you a tale to remember when the white horse's leap rings of fire. It was a cold night in old Oklahoma, and the show was about to begin. The animals, they were all restless when the star horse broke from her pen. Now she was a mare of high spirit, like a whore on a Saturday night, just a kicking and a bucking past the men that were brushing the elephants lying on their side. Now close to the tent sat a lantern, it was dangerously close to the hay. That mare straight for that lantern that some fool had left there by mistake. Well, up jumps an Indian cowboy, and his lasso whirls through the air in the full dead middle of danger. He ropes that runaway mare.
This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. And we're talking this hour with Joe Ely, Butch Hancock, and Jimmy Dale Gilmore, three titans of alt, country, and roots rock, who have come together again as the Flatlanders. And we're listening right now to Deep Eddie Blues.
Far from my heart, lost in my mind, Deep Eddie Blues, sometimes, sometimes.
And gentlemen, I think we'd all be interested in hearing a little bit more of your personal stories. Let me start with you, Joe Ely. Understand that you were born, well, not on Route 66, presumably, but somewhere pretty close to it.
I was born, just a few blocks from Route 66 in Amarillo, Texas. And then later on moved 17 feet and 120 miles downhill south to Lubbock, Texas.
And tell us a little bit about your journey along the way. I understand that you also play violin and Hawaiian guitar.
I started out playing violin when I was like 7 years old. And when I moved to Lubbock, Buddy Holly had just died. And everybody in Lubbock played some guitar of some kind. And a guy came around, a door-to-door, only in West Texas, I think, would there be a door-to-door steel guitar salesman. He was from the Dunnigan Hawaiian School of Music, and so I studied Hawaiian guitar for a few months until I found a Stratocaster. Buddy Holly kind of made the Stratocaster famous, and so after that I dropped the steel guitar and the violin, and started rock and roll band.
You've also written a play for musical theater, and you paint as well?
I've always done just a little bit of everything. It's all I spent about 10 years of my life just roaming around from coast to coast, and always carried a sketchbook in my guitar case. And I didn't have any outside entertainment when you're out there on the highway, and so I kind of made my own entertainment.
And tell me how the soundtrack music for The Horse Whisperer came about.
Well, I was working with MCA in Nashville with Tony Brown, and they were working on the soundtrack for this Robert Redford movie, and asked me if I wanted to write a song for it, and I said, sure, I'd try it. And the word got back to Montana, where they were making the movie, and somebody that was close to the music production knew that we used to be together with the Flatlanders and asked me if I could get in touch with Jimmy and Butch. And so we all got together and started writing songs, one song for this movie, and then songs just kept coming. We kept writing them. And that was kind of the catalyst that made us start writing for, that ended up to be the album Now Again.
So you did all the music for the movie?
No, we only did one song for this, for the CD, for the Horse Whisperer, but that started a role of us getting together writing songs.
Well, Butch, tell us a little bit about yourself. You had mentioned a moment ago that you were on the farm for a while out there riding on the tractor. Is that where some of your inspiration came from?
Well, actually, yeah, it's true. My dad had me out there driving a tractor all around Lubbock for quite a few years on summertime and after school. And I found out that second gear at two-thirds throttle on this old International Harvester tractor was the key of G.
Not many people know that.
That's right. Well, on this particular tractor it was. Anyway, by changing gears and speeding up and slowing down, I could play all kinds of tunes. And so I started carrying a little notebook out there and writing songs all day while driving a tractor. And things went from bad to worse there, and I wound up being a musician.
Well, actually a very successful one. You've had songs that were covered by Emmylou Harris and the Texas Tornadoes and others.
We've had a wonderful life here in Austin and got to meet so many great musicians and picking with everybody and meeting a lot of folks over the years and traveling with their music. It's been really good to us.
And Jimmy Dale, what should we know about your story?
Well, one interesting thing that we only figured out actually fairly recently was that I'm a couple of years older than Joe, but we were both born in the same hospital in Amarillo. And another very odd coincidence, my parents met each other in high school in Crest, Texas, which is population, I think, under 500. And a couple of years ago, we were talking about some family stuff or something, and it turned out that Joe's parents had also met each other in that same high school. And it's very weird. It's a very peculiar thing, but Joe and I were both born in Amarillo. Butch is the only actual Lubbock native of the gang. But we all grew up in Lubbock and were permanently scarred.
And well, transformed, let's say.
Blessed. We were blessed. I was blessed. Yeah. Scarred and blessed.
All right. Well, definitely hear those deep Texas roots in your music. What are you going to play for us now?
I believe we're going to do a song that Joe wrote.
I thought we were going to do Eggs of Your Chickens.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, were we? Oh,
yeah.
Oh, no.
We can do either
one.
Of
Butch's.
Yes. This is,
I looked at the list wrong.
People ask us why we named it, named the album Wheels of Fortune. And we have to say that the real reason is because we didn't want to name it The Eggs of Your Chickens.
Let's go, Roy.
Well, I've heard you say, little darling, we must do or die. Now, everything I'm doing, I've been dying to try. But I've stayed on your farm as long as I'm gonna stay. I've watched the eggs of your chickens roll away, roll away. I watched the eggs of your chickens roll away. Well, it's real well known that the road gets long, that the will gets weak when the wind gets strong. But I'll stay on my feet as long as I can stay, till the soles of my shoes wear away, wear away. Till the soles of my shoes wear away.
Take it, Rob.
Fighting when the cause is lost. But if you can't make the change, you'll have to pay and pay. Till the seams in your pockets pull away, pull away. Till the seams in your pockets pull away. My time and my attention, they're wearing kind of thin. You've been taking it all for granted, should have been taking it with a grin. You paint a pretty picture, but your mind goes astray. When the image of your lover fades away, fades away. When the image of your lover fades away. Sit still like the mountains do. But I've stayed on your farm as long as I'm gonna stay. I've watched the eggs of your chickens roll away, roll away. I watched the eggs of your chickens roll away.
And again, that was Eggs of Your Chickens or Eggs from Your Chickens? Maybe we should be clear on that point.
Those would be your Eggs of Your Chickens.
Okay. Well, I can see why you might not want that as the title of the CD, but it is a great song. I want to take a moment here and give you a chance to introduce the other members of the group there who are performing for us.
Yeah, we're glad to have Chris Searles playing drums and percussion with us, and Gary Herman playing bass guitar. And Rob Gerso playing electric guitar and 12-string.
And maybe we should also note, Joe, that we are hearing you from your studio. I presume that you are out in the country far enough to not to be annoying to the neighbors?
We're way out in the country. We can rattle all night and not disturb anybody.
And actually, I shouldn't say that you'd be annoying the neighbors, because probably they'd be opening up their windows and doors and wanting to listen in on this.
Not at 4 a.m.
Well, that's true. Perhaps at a somewhat more reasonable hour. Well, what's the next song you're going to do?
I think we're going to do one that I wrote back, actually, around the time that we did the first album, when we were hanging out in lower downtown Nashville. It's called Neon of Nashville. She was raised on a river by the chapel where the church bells pealed, between a line of peach trees and a brown tobacco field. Her eyes shone turquoise and her hair was a waterfall, and everyone from miles around swore that she'd go far. They sing of her beauty in Georgia and on the Carolina coast, and they almost seem to sing of her like she was a ghost. The city lights lured her to the glitter of the silver state. Beauty was so astounding that it made her too easily made. High society dragged her down to where the loneliness was too much to bear. She faded from the limelight. No one knew just where. Sing of her beauty in Georgia and on the Carolina coast, down in the neon of Nashville. She was a ghost. Now someone said they saw her years later at the bottom of fifth of whiskey in her hand, codeine in her brain. When they hummed her song about the peach trees and the brown tobacco field, her eyes grew distant. She whispered, "Listen, there's the chapel where the church bells peal." Sing of her beauty in Georgia and on the Carolina coast, down in the neon of Nashville. They almost seem to sing of her
like she was a ghost.
Butch Hancock and Jimmy Dale Gilmore, the Flatlanders live with Neon of Nashville. Was that about a particular person, or was that trying to summarize the hopes and dreams of so many thousands of people who come to Nashville every year and just don't make it?
It was actually about some one person that I met there that had a huge hit recording and was then really down and out on the streets just like 2 years later and was catching a bus back home to North Carolina. Mm. And I don't know the name or anything, but Nashville's, there's thousands of stories like that, and that one just particularly grabbed me, you know, at the time.
It makes it even sadder that you can't remember her name.
Well, unless you actually knew it very well at one point, and now you can't remember it.
That makes it, that would be even sadder.
Makes it sadder.
But I guess that's an all-too-common experience, I mean, which I think is why it resonates with everybody.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I guess that could have been the Flatlanders, too. But we didn't take things very seriously, so we just kind of sung our way through the hard times.
Well, and you clearly prevailed. This hour's guests are the Flatlanders, Joe Ely, Butch Hancock, and Jimmy Dale Gilmore. We're going to take a break now, and we'll go into it listening to Midnight Train. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we'll be right back with more.
That midnight train is a long and a slow. Timetable set, the brakeman is tired. Your seat is reserved with exceptions for no. No luggage allowed, no ticket required. It will be there right on time at the station. Even if midnight must come at high noon, and you will not know you'll not leave late, no 1 minute too soon.
This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're listening to the Flatlanders, who are joining us this hour from Austin, Texas. Joe Ely, Butch Hancock, and Jimmy Dale Gilmore first recorded as the Flatlanders in 1972, and now they're back on the road again with their new CD, Wheels of Fortune.
I'm gonna strangle you, shorty. Lord, Lord, Lordy. That is what she said. I'm gonna strangle you, shorty. Lord, Lord, Lordy. Your way up over your head. Tuscaloosa, found a bar by the side of the road. I ordered us an order of French fries. Shorty went to lighten his load. The waitress happened to see him. I never seen any woman so sore. The skillet come a flying out the kitchen. Shorty running out the door. I'm gonna strangle you, Shorty. Lord, Lord, Lordy. And that is what she said. I'm gonna strangle you, Shorty. Lord, Lord, Lordy.
You know, guys, when you stop and think that your combined ages add up to 175, does that make a difference in your music that you really do have this voice of experience, and clearly it comes across?
When you subtract our ages, it comes to minus 100. we just picked everything up just by going through this world. And, you know, it shows in all the records, just, you know, there's all different styles and all different things, but it's all just part of living in the place that we live in.
Is it a hindrance, though, in a musical industry that seems to be very focused on the, you know, the 13-year-olds and up, but you're able to find your audience?
The thing about it is that if you really want to really succeed in a really stupid industry, you can go do really stupid stuff. So.
Well, but I don't think anybody's going to describe your work as stupid, but does it take extra work?
We don't want to succeed.
Is it a little harder to find the people who really are going to love hearing your music? Because I guess it's something of a challenge to get playtime on radio stations, for instance.
I don't know. You know,
that's always been a problem, though. You know,
I'm not sure that that radio always plays to the people who want to hear music. You know, sometimes it's just plays to people who want to fill the space or something. So we've always had an audience. So we're not trying to find a certain kind of audience. I don't think we're directing it at anybody.
Who comes
except to ourselves?
Yeah, we've never really thought of making music as something for the radio. It's always been kind of an ongoing journal for us. It's just a journal of our lives. The songs are little stories that happened as we pass through from time to time. So it's really more of a ongoing little book.
And who turns out when you perform live?
It's gone through a lot of strange, different phases. And after Now Again, there was something really strange happened, which was that Don Imus just loved the record. And he, lots of his audience started listening to the Flatlanders, which
is a very weird,
very strange thing. And they people started showing up at our gigs, you know, like. They'd hang around, you know, and ask for autographs and stuff. And after the show, a lot of them told us that it was the first time they'd been out to a concert in 20 years or something. They don't go out anymore. But I don't know.
It's
that's just like one odd phase that's happened.
You know, college kids and, you know, it's like all ages. I don't know. It's amazing.
Well, and your CDs have also gotten a lot of critical acclaim. I wonder, what's your favorite of all the things that have been written about you?
Boy, let me think. There's a really good one in there somewhere.
There's some really funny ones and some very, very, very glowing, true ones.
Gut Bucket Transcendental Rock, I think was it.
So do you put a yellow marker on those and kind of hang them up strategically around the house? Well, let me ask
those kind of things you don't want to throw away. Yeah, make great bumper stickers or something. Yeah.
But do you ever read a review and think, this person just doesn't get it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
Yeah. I don't know. The reviews on the last two records have been amazing, really.
And did that surprise you?
It did surprise us because, I mean, when you're coming at it from there, I think a lot of people expected to hear the new records to be just like the one from the first record, and they were nothing at all like that record. And so we didn't know what to expect. We thought maybe it might make some people mad, and I guess maybe it did, but we just did it the way that tried to be honest with it and tried to play it as we felt like it right now.
Well, clearly a few things had happened to you in the intervening 30 years.
Yeah, right. We're not even... don't even have the same molecules in our brains as we did then.
Mm. So what do you want to do musically in the future that you have not been able to do yet?
Well, let's see.
I'd like to kind of do that
we
gig,
want to take over
that
the government.
Gig on the Eiffel Tower that we've been talking about for years.
Yeah, and floating backwards down the Mississippi River.
Okay, how about musically? I mean, I assume there are lots more songs where that came from all of your fertile brains.
Right.
Floating backward on the Mississippi.
Yeah, that's a whole concept album.
What is happening next? I mean, are you writing some more songs or thinking about yet another CD, or is it too soon to ask that question?
We're really just starting out on the life of this one, I think. And once again, I sort of suspect we don't really project that much into the future. We never have made a career plan or anything. It never did fall apart. The plan didn't fall apart because there wasn't one there. But we and we just kind of know, though, that, you know, when we spend a lot of time together, something always comes out of it. And we also have a whole bunch of old songs that we still want to record. So we probably will be doing a lot of recording from now on, but it's not according to some, you know, to like marketing plan or anything.
Well, it has certainly been such a pleasure to listen to you this hour. Thank you so much for being with us, Joe Ely, Butch Hancock, and Jimmy Dale Gilmore.
Thanks for having us here. Yeah.
And you can find out more about the Flatlanders at onpointradio.org. And we're going to leave you now with See the Way from their new CD, Wheels of Fortune. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
You're going to be sad till you stop hurting for the sake of finding peace of mind. Rise up from there, throw back the curtain that covers your heart and makes you blind. See the way true love has left you for a life that you must feed. See the way true love has left you for what you want but just don't need.
You'll bind the wounds till you stop bleeding for the love you gave but could not take, for a love that burns, for a love that's leading straight to the heart.
A year ago this month, Atlantic Monthly editor Michael Kelly became the first American journalist killed while covering the war in Iraq. Kelly had been embedded with the Army's 3rd Infantry Division when he died in a Humvee accident. Kelly's writings have been collected in a new anthology titled Things Worth Fighting For. This month, some of Kelly's fellow writers and former colleagues have read pieces from that anthology at tribute events in Boston, New York, and Washington. The readers have included Dan Rather, Ted Koppel, and Bob Woodward. Tonight, we bring you Pulitzer Prize-winning author Samantha Power, reading a 1998 piece written by Kelly about Bob Dole's humanitarian mission to Bosnia to search for thousands of missing civilians.
The piece I'm about to read is called Where Are the Dead? And I think what makes it emblematic and, again, important is it reflects, I think, Mike's eye for that which is intrinsically important, not just that which is going to generate headlines, but that actually there are certain crimes and certain human reactions to suffering that are just intrinsically worth covering, again, regardless of the effect sometimes even on readership. The second reason I think this piece is illustrative in important ways is it reveals in its discussion of Bob Dole, I think, something else very special about Mike, which is his love of America and ordinary America and his desire always to see the better angels of America come forward and represent this country abroad. So this is called Where Are the Dead? One afternoon in the early autumn of 1995, as the war in Bosnia was entering its last weeks, I was driving in a slanting, thick rain on a back road from the city of Bihać to the city of Sazin, and I stopped to pick up a soldier who was hitchhiking to the front about 15 miles away. The soldier belonged to the 511th Brigade of the Bosnian Army's 5th Corps, one of the two best brigades and what was by far the best corps in the Army. He wore a uniform rigged out of cast-offs from other armies and sneakers on his feet. I guess he was 18 or 19 years old. He had no hair on his face except a straggling of thin black shoots on his upper lip, and he was thin like most people in the Bihać area at that time. His skin was faintly yellowing from malnutrition, which was also common. He climbed into the back seat and lit a cigarette. It was late in the day, almost dusk and chilly. I had the heat on, with my window open only a few inches, and the cigarette smoke and the steam from his rain-wet clothes made a homey smell of burning tobacco and damp wool. When he had finished the cigarette, he stubbed out the butt in the ashtray in the door handle and began talking. He spoke in Serbo-Croatian, or Bosnian, as he would have said, and the translator retooled his words into English, which lent a slightly unreal and theatrical distance to them, as if they were coming from the radio. He said that a few days before, in the aftermath of the Fifth Corps' successful effort to drive the Serbs out of Bosanska Krupa, he had been walking in the woods of a hill overlooking the town when he had come upon, unexpectedly, a Serb soldier, whom he captured without incident. As he stood there, pointing his rifle at his prisoner, he realized that he knew the man. They'd grown up together and had gone to school together in the city of Prijedor, about 50 miles from where they now stood, a place where both Muslims and Serbs had long lived as neighbors. In April 1992, near the beginning of the war, the Serbs of Prijedor took control of the city in a swift, brutal coup and began killing and expelling the Muslims there as part of an ethnic cleansing sweep through northern Bosnia. The captured Serb soldier had taken part in this. The Bosnian soldier who was telling me the story in the car on the way to Sazin had fled Prijedor with all his family except for his father. His father had refused to leave their home, and he had been missing ever since. "What happened to my father?" the Bosnian soldier asked the Serb soldier. The Serb was silent for a moment, and then he said, "I'm sorry to say, he's not alive. He died soon after you left Prijedor." He didn't say, but neither did he have to say, that the Bosnian soldier's father had died because the Serbs had killed him. "You remember that we were friends," the Serb said. The Bosnian didn't say anything. "You remember that we were classmates." The Bosnian still didn't say anything. "Is there a future, do you think, for Bosnians and Serbs together in this country?" the Serb asked. At this point, my passenger, sitting there in the back seat in the washing day warmth, said, "So I said to him, 'Yes, there is a future, but not for you and me.' And then I shot him." Given all these difficulties, Mike goes on to say later in the piece, the task of hunting for the missing requires a special person. You need someone who is at least a little desperate for something to do with his life, someone with a solid streak of perversity, someone who is attracted to failed causes and dismal realities. You need, in a sense, a loser. Early last fall, it occurred to President Clinton that Bob Dole would be ideal for the job. Dole was happy to get the call from the president. He had been one of Bosnia's most serious supporters in American politics, and his commitment is emotional, that of someone who has a visceral knowledge of war. When I asked him why he'd gotten involved, he replied with a sort of stream of consciousness disgust. "You know, nobody was paying attention, things would happen, the president wouldn't do anything, nobody was doing anything, and you would have terrible things happen, Srebrenica, women and children not being able to walk the streets in Sarajevo, and you just see more and more of it every day on television, you hear more and more of it, you have to do something, you really do."
Pulitzer Prize-winning author Samantha Power, reading a 1998 piece written by the late Atlantic Monthly editor Michael Kelly. Kelly was killed 1 year ago this month while serving as an embedded reporter in Iraq. To hear other readings of Kelly's work from political humorist P.J. O'Rourke, Black Hawk Down author Mark Bowden, and On Point's own Tom Ashbrook, among others, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.